Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Elliot Dasher, who is the author of Aware, Awake, Alive, A Contemporary Guide to the Ancient Science of Integral Health and Human Flourishing. Dr. Dasher practiced full-time internal medicine from 1975 to 1996, left his medical practice to explore consciousness research, spirituality, and its relationship to health. He's the author of several books, Integral Health, The Path to Human Flourishing, Whole Healing, and Intentional Healing. These books were written, I believe, before Aware, Awake, and Alive. And he's going to talk to us today about how we apply these principles for a better life. Welcome, Dr. Dasher.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here with you.
So would you like to give your listening audience a little bit about background information on your spiritual journey?
Yeah, we can do that. I both had training as a conventional physician. I practiced internal medicine for about 21 years. This would be roughly 1975 to 1995-96. And during that period of time, I began to see the gamut of concerns that people had, and apply the usual remedies and approaches to these problems. But it became apparent to me in time that there was more to the problem than merely the physical aspect of it, though that may well take care of symptoms. It really didn't address the underlying cause, or even more than that, help to enhance the quality of an individual's life. So I became active at that point in the wellness movement, the holistic movement, the integrative care movement, developmental psychology, many of the things that people were placing their fingers in and then incorporating into their practices, which I did. And I think it helped the bottom line a bit with people, gave them more awareness, more understanding, more skills and capacities relative to their problems. But when my children were about to finish college and I sat back and decided what I wanted to do next, it came apparent to me that even with the direction I was going, I had not gotten to the level of healing and health and well-being that was important to me both personally and to the clients that I served. So when my children were no longer the same responsibility that they had once been, I really made up my mind to just stop and to see what was next in my life. And so I actually gave up my practice, gave up my home, moved to a summer home I had for many years in Ireland, in the Northeast, and began to pretty much be quiet and sit around and see what was next, because the great stories always tell you that when you want to change, you've really got to sit in the unknown for a while. Otherwise, you're just you're involved with rearranging furniture in the same room. And I eventually found myself in India, somewhat by an accident, actually, and I began to come in touch with the Tibetan people at that particular time, the Dalai Lama, other teachers, and I saw on their faces, in their demeanor, and in their presence that which I was seeking in my own life, that sense of wellness and well-being that I really thought was missing and that I hadn't achieved with all of my adventures into these complementary approaches. And so whatever they had, I figured I should find out what it was. So for the next 12 years, I spent 3 to 4 months a year, sometimes 6 months, studying psychology, philosophy, and meditation practice in Asia with these wonderful teachers, largely with the Dalai Lama, but with other teachers as well. And I consider this my second medical education, my first one being in the physical, conventional aspects of healing, and this being in the inner aspects of healing. And when I came back, I was perfectly capable of integrating both of them and quite accepting of Western medicine in its context with a broader approach, and began to teach and write. And out of a course that I did for many years, still do, the book Aware, Awake, Alive sort of unfolded itself. So my work now is mostly working with consciousness studies and with teaching meditation, because there are many other people who can do the physical aspects of medicine, and that's probably where my contribution is greatest. And so that's what I do now. and help people approach their well-being, emotional, physical, and spiritual, through an inner development, let's say, and I put that word in quotes, but through coming to know the inner space that we have within ourselves. So that would
be
the nutshell.
Do you have a website? Okay. Do you have a website you'd like to give? Yeah.
Yeah, it would be www.mynamedot.com. Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T-T, last name D-A-C-H-E-R, well, one word, .org, Elliot-Dasher.org.
Right. Well, you've divided your book into four parts. The first one is called The Vision. Would you like to expand on that?
Well, if we want to go someplace or accomplish something, we have to have a vision about what we want to do, which shapes our intention and our direction. So the vision is really important. What is it that we really want in our health and our well-being, and what kind of a life do we want? And meditation and inner practices really have two parts to them. The first really is creating a healthy human life, and this is the most ordinary aspect of meditation, where people learn it mostly as a relaxation or a mindfulness technique, and they are able to achieve more stable inner peace, less reactivity, a better clarity about what's happening around them, improved relationships, and so on. And that's the way meditation basically came into the West. And the second part of the vision has to do with achieving a sense of human flourishing, which is learning to be present or available to our authentic and natural self within, not the usual ordinary I self, but the deeper self of awareness and the presence of being. So these would correspond to the two aspects of the vision really being to achieve the maximal sense of health and well-being for ourselves, for those around us, and for our planet. And so in the beginning, we set a vision. So when I begin to work with people, whether that would be medically or within a spiritual realm, these are the two steps I lay out. There are things we can do to create a healthy human life: nutrition, exercise, mindfulness, more relaxation, a deeper understanding of our psychology, and so on. And then there is the experience of living in our authentic self or authentic presence, which isn't something we can so much do as point ourselves in the direction of. So it's these two aims that I work with people. The first is health improvement. The second is human flourishing. And they're both really important. So that is the basic vision. And that health really is integral in nature and has to do with our attention to our relationships, our work in the world, our consciousness, as well as our mind, our body. But the emphasis that I feel is most important is the work on our consciousness, because you can't have a healthy relationship to others, to the world, without having a higher level of consciousness or awareness. You can't really transform work into service or otherness without a higher level of awareness and consciousness and capacity. And the same with the body. To use much more subtle mind-body approaches, you have to have much more subtle consciousness. So that basically encapsulates what I would say is the vision in that first section of the book.
Okay, well, part two is the path. I guess that's how you get there.
Yeah, that is how you get there and how you begin to take that intention, that vision, and begin to actualize it in one's own life. And so we begin and focus initially on how it is that we can improve the quality of our life, which is a process of self-improvement and self-development, and how we can bring ourselves to a place where, as I said, we're less reactive, we're more peaceful, we're more calm, we're clearer about what's happening around us, so we're able to function in a better way in our relationships and our work, etc. So in this particular section, we really cover the gamut of the human condition. We talk about suffering. What is the cause of suffering? How can we bring suffering to an end? And many people say that's not possible. And of course it's possible. It's not possible to bring life's challenges to an end or to bring all this comfort to an end. But suffering, the angst, the fear, the anxiety, the worry, all that we project onto it can be brought to an end. How to deal with emotional afflictions, that's the overactive mind with its thoughts, emotions, and feelings that are disturbing, that we ruminate on, how we deal with that. How we can use different aspects of our life to take us down this path, how we can transform our work so it becomes a spiritual practice, how we can transform our relationships or use our relationships as a spiritual practice or a practice of self-realization or self-understanding, how we can use our daily activities as places to practice mindfulness and to again see the clarity of the phenomenal world, the world around us, that is not influenced by our past experiences, how to see it more clearly. So the first section of the book deals with this whole area of how do we bring our life from distress to a place of peace, and by the understanding of how we can use all the aspects of life to bring suffering and distress to an end and to bring ourselves, therefore, into a much better relationship to our daily life and the people around us. That would be that second section.
So lots of times we see that we're attracting the same thing again and again. Michael Rice wrote a book called Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And what I see in that is that the lessons that you fail to learn are brought to you in another form, but with a lot of similarities. And that's often true in relationships.
Yeah, I definitely could say that does occur in that way. There's another way to look at it from the larger dimension of inner development. When you come to the end of self-development, you really have to decide whether you're going to make the jump into a life that goes beyond our day-to-day ordinary self. By the way, what I mean by our ordinary self and our ordinary mind is our personality with its habitual perspectives, its ways of seeing things the same way, its habits of reaction, its habits of attraction, as you're saying, its desires, its preferences, its past history. This all constitutes what we call ourself, also our identity, our judgments, our beliefs, our thoughts or images or feelings. This is all our ordinary day-to-day self. And we can improve that in the manner that I've just spoken of, but we can't really get to the core of the problem by self-development. And that's really one of the substantial issues that we all have to take up in our own life. The reason we can't is because the very self that we're working to transform, that we're working to change, this self-image we have, this storyline or narrative about our life that's all based on past experience brought into the present or future, this is a man-made mental concoction that begins sometime in childhood as we begin to accumulate experience and to accumulate a psychology. It's a mental experience. It has no solidity behind it. So this I that we are so involved with and that we are so work so hard to self-improve, in the process of doing that, we unfortunately also concretize the illusion or confusion that this identity that we hold as ourself, we think it to be solid, real, independent, autonomous, something really out there. And it isn't that way. It's simply a collection of our past experiences kind of tied together like a pearl necklace with our mind, and we call it who we are. Changes constantly. Our identities change. Our beliefs change. Our attitudes change. It's completely unstable. And so long as we're attached to it and its preferences and its desires, even at the most subtle level, we are susceptible to them reemerging again. And it's only when we take this final step in inner development in which we find the true self, which is not a personal self, which is not in history, which is not filled with ideas or judgments or reactions or patterns or perceptions, but it's a place of being, a place of presence, a place of simple, pure awareness that we can rest in and learn to rest in easily. And many of us have touched this. We've touched it when we've been immersed in nature and our mind, cognitive mind, has been suspended. And all of a sudden, we're in this flow. We're not there as a person. We're there as enormous presence, beauty, art, dance, music, exercise, romance, sex. These are all touches of this place in which we lose ourselves, so to say, and then find our authentic self. Only when we do that and rest in that self, which was there from the beginning, is always there, and has no history associated with it, has never been contaminated by anything we've learned, only there are we finally and completely free. And free of what? Free of the influences of the mind, both in perspectives and both in actions. And so in answer to your question, the real freedom, the full freedom, one has to go beyond the ordinary eye. Because even when we improve that and know all the problems, you know, all the things we do, it's the essence of these issues are still there in a very subtle way. So they can, like weeds in the garden, come back, even if we pluck them out pretty well. So I don't know if that's clear, but that would be the best way I can answer that question.
So that's why meditation is so important, because as long as we have the chatter and the constant thoughts running through our head, we're not able to really bring this authentic self through, because the mind's just too preoccupied with other things. And meditation is really just the practice of clearing the mind, not going against the thoughts, but just sort of watching them, observing them, letting them go. And then with time, you just go around not really thinking, but with more of a clear, still mind that can then get impressions from the higher self. And these impressions are actually very protective and very educational, because it's information that you don't have at a personality level, but that can be very, very useful. I mean, I still continue to practice medicine. I'll walk in a room and I had a patient with seizures that had been at many different institutions, Mayo, Hopkins, Emory. Nobody could control their seizures. I walked in and the first question I asked is, how much Diet Coke do you drink? And he said, a liter a day. I said, stop it. And that's all it took to stop his seizures. Now, how did I ask that question? I've never asked that question on a patient before. How much Diet Coke do you drink? But you see, you have that clear mind, and you can ask the right question.
Yeah, and you know, we don't have an appreciation or access to that type of knowing that you just spoke about. There is cognitive knowing that is part of our personality or our ordinary identity, in which we know things in the form of information, things we have learned, knowledge we've accumulated, and so on, which is informs our decisions and our choices, not only forms them, it limits them, it structures them according to what our knowledge base is. But that kind of reasoning and logic, which is helpful in many things, it's helpful if you want to build a machine or drive a car, but it's not very helpful in the psychological sphere or in other spheres. And in this place of presence and beingness, there isn't also a knowing. It's more, we can call it a cognizance rather than a cognition. It's maybe we can call it intuitive knowing. That's kind of a mixed word, so it's a little difficult. But there is a knowing. So if a mother is in a boat with her infant child and the child falls overboard, then the mother doesn't go to the cognitive mind to think about what to do. It would never happen. The cognitive mind physiologically is suspended. It stops the thinking mind. And the knowing to jump into that water is not a cognitive process. It's known to that mother very quickly, instantaneously, and in the moment there is the suspension of the cognition which blocks it. If you walk in front of a car and you look at it coming right at you, cognitive mind suspends itself, stops. If it didn't, we'd be in a thought process and hit quite quickly. And the body knows immediately to move away without any thought process at all. So that knowing, you know, can be developed as part of that presence. It cannot be had, as you had just mentioned, in our usual ordinary mind or usual eye or personality, because it is so overwhelmed by the all of the thoughts, the feelings, and the cognitions that we've accumulated, and it blocks it. So there has to become a trust in a kind of knowing in which we suspend the cognitive mind with all its accumulated knowledge and allow this knowing that comes from who knows where just to come forth as it did for you.
Like with the cognitive mind, and I'm not a neurologist, so I don't know all the causes of seizures. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I was in neurosurgery, so I know traumas, you know, tumors and other things. You know, if you fall on your head, you might have seizures later. But a cognitive mind would take all of the different differential diagnoses and then eliminate them, you know, with a history and physical type thing and MRIs or whatever else. But and I'm sure that was done at these other centers. And I didn't even really realize until after I had studied this a little bit more that aspartame in some individuals can cause a very resistant seizure disorder. I wasn't aware of that fact.
Yeah.
So well, whatever made me ask that question had nothing to do with my knowledge of medicine.
Yeah, we would never know what made it happen.
It out, you know?
Because there's no reason and logic in that state of being, that presence. It's really
right.
Sort of in
tune. You go right for it, you know? It's like,
yeah.
But it's very useful in medicine and in surgery. It's very useful to, and I've been in very difficult surgical situations where I was guided with that same type of intuitive guidance that got me out of the trouble. And it was unusual stuff, things that I would not have normally known to do.
Yeah. Well, I think we learned to trust that after a while. It doesn't mean that we don't use our cognitive minds and how to tie a suture or whatever.
We
but it,
do. Yeah.
It means there is a knowing within ourselves. And out of that knowing actually comes a very different action that comes out of our usual ordinary mind and usual ordinary self. Because the action we always take are reactions, and they're based upon our past history, how it interprets the circumstance, what we've learned, and how we've learned to react and judge, and so on. But action that comes from a place that is free of past history and can clearly see the situation because it isn't involved in all kinds of veiled ideas and understandings about it, there's a clarity that leads to an action that is precise to the circumstance as it is. Not precise to our past history as it interprets the situation. So not only does this authentic self, this place of presence of being, it's always there. We can learn how to drop into it and stay there for longer periods. So not only does it provide a deep sense of peace, contentment, wisdom, compassion, many things that are very natural to it, but it also has this clarity of vision and therefore clarity of action that cannot come from any place else.
I also think that you see a lot of the miracles coming out of this. You know, the story about the mother that lifts the car off her child. You know, there's been reports of superhuman strength. But, you know, if you were in your cognitive mind, you would not really attempt to lift the car up because you knew you couldn't do it. You know, it's like you'd defeat that before you even tried it because logically you can't lift the car up.
That's
so
correct.
There's all sorts of things that have happened in emergency situations that.
You see, emergency situations or situations that are of shock, like the two I described, stepping in front of a car or any other kind of shock, even a loud, very loud noise that shocks you. If you're very careful, mm-hmm. You'll see that in the seconds after that, the cognitive mind is suspended. It stops. And in that gap, what's present is just presence, because it's always there mm-hmm. all the time. And whenever we unveil that, it comes forward. We can do that consciously through meditation and other practices. But any sudden experience, any shock to the system will suddenly suspend the cognitive mind. And when that's suspended, what mm-hmm. comes forth is that natural presence that's already there.
Right. So the next section is called the fruition. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. Here we're talking about what begins to evolve as we move towards and drop into this place of our natural self, this place of presence, of beingness, of you can call it pure awareness of spaciousness, of light, has a sense of emptiness and that it's not filled up with all the noise. As we begin to learn how to drop into this place, and it's not something that's all that difficult. The usual cognitive mind will tell us, well, it's really hard. You can't do it. Take forever. How many years am I going to have to work on it? How many things am I going to have to do? So when we approach this issue of our authentic self from the perspective of our ordinary mind, it seems like we'll never be able to accomplish it. It'll take forever. But when we begin to drop into it, we see it lives in timelessness. And actually, it's spontaneously there whenever we enter it. And when we begin to stabilize this sense of presence and awareness, which is not personal, you can't find the person when you're there. If you go have an experience in which there is this flow, there is this openness and spaciousness of the space, if you went to say to yourself, where is my I there? Where is my sense of self? You wouldn't find it. It's not there. And as one begins to enter that, there are qualities that emerge from that space that are natural, that are effortless, and you can call them sort of the perfume of our authentic space or presence or beingness or natural awareness. The very qualities that we work so hard to improve and develop during our lifetime, which is our compassion, wisdom, and love, and happiness, etc., that we try to develop and cultivate by improving the quality of our life and our behavior, are spontaneously and naturally present within that aspect of ourself. So when we are in that aspect of ourself, we begin to really taste and live the qualities of human flourishing, the qualities of that place of presence that has so many names, whether it's a Buddhahood or Christ nature or the Tao or Satchitananda, or eudaimonia that Aristotle used, or the word human flourishing we currently use. All of these natural qualities are there effortlessly and spontaneously arising. The ones we work so hard to try to perfect during our lifetime are already perfected in this space, once we can stabilize it over time. So this section goes through the different qualities and, for instance, freedom. Freedom can be seen as economic freedom or social freedom in the conventional world that we live in. But here we're talking about a freedom from the influences of our past, freedom from habitual patterns of perception and reaction, a freedom to be who we are, not limited, bounded by, or shaped by any previous experience, cultural, personal. And so we begin to talk about the distinction between these qualities as they emerge in their fullness, which can only be in our natural self, and how they are as they are cultivated in a facsimile of that in the process of self-improvement or working on our ordinary life. So this section is devoted to really looking at those qualities.
Great. Well, part four is called the integration, and here you talk about different disorders, addiction, heart disease, chronic disorders, depression, ADD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I kind of look at the way I approach thinking about the illness or the not being in perfect health is one of three areas. One is environmental, and that especially because we live in kind of a toxic environment. These are physical things. Like I spend a lot of time removing defective breast implants that are making people sick. That's chemical silicone toxicity, biotoxicity from mold. Defective breast implant patients have candidiasis. They have intracellular infections. They have viruses and sometimes even parasites because T-cell immunity is affected. So a lot of their illness is simply environmental. And so you're not dealing so much with the emotional aspect other than anger because you have a chronic illness from a product that was supposed to be safe. But the majority of what you have to do to get these people better is really environmental. And then there's attitude, which is mental and emotional. And as you said before, the wrong attitude can certainly affect your health. There's a lot of psychological implications for a disease that won't be cured until these are addressed. And then there's karmic. Karmic is a little bit more esoteric, but I found a lot of RSD patients and neuropathic pain patients had karmic causes to their disease. And interestingly enough, they had about 7 years. They'll be in pain for about 7 years. Now, you can give them pain medicine. You can do different things, you know, nerve blocks and different things that are done. But they'll have the disorder for about 7 years. And then often at 7 or 14 or whatever period of time they have it, then it'll go away, which is very interesting because it, you know, it comes without a reason and it goes without a reason. And so the more mysterious things could be karmic.
Got it. So I think so what you're saying is that disease like health has each aspect of it has multiple components to it, that nothing is singular. Even if we talk about the environment, the choices we make about the environment, how we go about relating to it, what we do to it, et cetera, these are choices that we have that are related to our mind and the quality of our understanding. So all things are really shaped, including the mind, by multiple factors that are part of the causal realm of things. And what happens in medicine is that, as you well know, gets reduced to a certain kind of physical formula, which at times may be helpful, but does not address really the multiple other factors that you've mentioned that together combine to create particularly chronic disease.
Right. Like with cancer, I found that cancer is a fourth dimensional intrusion into the third dimension into an organ of low energy. So I'll just take breast as an example. I saw several breast cancers today. If the most common cause of cancer, primary cancer, in my experience, is emotional. And if you look at Hammer's work, you can see that in a right-handed person, a left-sided breast cancer is usually due to someone that was supposed to protect them betraying them. But a right-sided breast cancer is usually somebody that they're nurturing or protecting, either getting in trouble, rejecting them, dying, or almost dying. A dog dying can even cause a right breast cancer. So it's very different, and each organ is different in terms of what the emotional cause is. Kidney cancer often has to do with victims in relationships, and pancreatic cancer often has to do with a very dark energy of being very unhappy with God, being very bitter about somebody taken from you. Now, you don't just have emotional, though. I had a patient who had pancreatic cancer only from geopathic stress, which is underground stream or underground low energy where he was sleeping, and electromagnetic. And the electromagnetic was only the smart meter. So this guy had stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And just by treating the cause and then putting him on a medication that would decrease that fourth to third dimensional energy transfer, he remained alive he's over 3 years. He's alive now with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. So if you treat the cause of the disease, and it can be radiation, hormonal, geopathic stress, toxic chemical, generational curse, or electromagnetic is a very big one. And people need to make sure their smart meters are not near where they sleep or work, because they produce a Wi-Fi and they can be on gas, electric, or water. And that is very common now, especially for recurrent cancer. So you see how emotional can be the cause of cancer only, or it can be only electromagnetic or geopathic stress. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and how do you feel that the genetics fit into this?
Well, in my experience, most of the genetic cancers are generational curse. Again, if you think about what a fourth dimensional intrusion is into the third dimension, that's a curse. And people don't understand curses. They, you know, a lot of people that are educated in medical school would say they don't exist. But in actuality, it's an energetic transfer is what it is. So I'm going to give you an example of that. If you understand spontaneous remission, that there's been many, many documented instances of spontaneous remission of cancer. Sometimes it takes weeks, but often it takes minutes. And the scenario is usually the same. There's an energy at the top of the crown that then goes through the body, might take 30 seconds to get through. But by the time it reaches the feet, there's no more cancer in the body. And there could have been metastatic cancer before. I had a friend who was in my meditation group at the age of 36. She had metastatic breast cancer. She was in the hospital. She was supposed to go into surgery because she had one met that was eroding through her intestine, and they had to cut out a piece of her intestine. And she experienced this in the hospital room. She had a energy at her crown. It went through to her feet, and then no more tumors. The tumors were all gone. So she had her surgeon come by, and she said, "I'm hungry." And she said, "And my tumors went away." So he took her hand and said, "You've had a miracle here, and I'm canceling your surgery." But that is a fifth dimensional energy, okay, an energy coming from a much higher level. It could be called scalar energy that is kicking a fourth dimensional energy out. Because remember I said cancer is a fourth dimensional intrusion into the third. You have to be able to explain spontaneous remission if you are going to understand the cause of cancer. So in my experience, generational curses would be eventually in the genetics as the gene expressions that would cause the high cancer rates. I had an example, a very interesting patient come in. She had stage 4 breast cancer. And the only cause, I test the cause with applied kinesiology. The only cause she had was generational curse. Now, this is very interesting. She grew up in South America, which doesn't have a lot of chemical toxicity like the U.S. does. And I think 4 of her cousins also had breast cancer in their 20s and 30s. But none of the parents of these children had breast cancer. So the curse was recent. Okay, it wasn't like many generations. But the only cause she had was generational curse. Isn't that fascinating?
And this affects itself in genetics.
Well, I don't know with her. I mean, she wasn't BRCA positive, but I think if it continues, I think it becomes genetic.
Yeah, and as you well know, in the field of epigenetics now, that even genetics is not destiny. That there are various factors that regulate whether a gene expresses itself or not. So would it be an appropriate statement to say that what you're calling a curse or a karma, I'm not sure whether it's the same thing or not, this also, its manifestation, may also be dependent on other regulatory mechanisms that may have to do with biology, psyche, or who knows what?
I think that's true. And the interesting thing is that I can't do this because I'm not a shaman, but there are shamans that I know, Christian shamans, that can remove curses. And they go through a very specific, you know, way to do this. And they're trained. I mean, I wouldn't recommend anybody try to do this without training. But curses can be removed. And doing so would really help other people in the family, because if this is really true, then other generations would be potentially susceptible to the same curse.
Got
there are books written on generational curses and cancer. I mean, it is a real thing. That so that's why I think that the idea that cancer is a fourth dimensional intrusion into the third does explain all of the different causes. It explains why we have spontaneous remission, and it explains why Abilify, which is an antipsychotic, I'm sure you're familiar with it, is effective in stopping cancer. there's a number of things in the peer-reviewed literature that people put on Abilify and other antipsychotics have had cancer regress with no other treatment.
If one stepped out of one's, if one stepped into a place of presence that was, or full awareness, or let us even say the divine, that is, uncontaminated by history, past history, whether it's personal, collective, ancestral, would it be your thought then that one would, in that space, have an immunity built into the causes of those things which occur psychically in a temporal fashion?
I think it depends on what it is. There's usually a chakra disruption. People who can see chakras see a disrupted chakra, and years before anybody develops cancer. So Carolyn Mace talks about this, but there's an energetic disruption probably 5 years before you develop cancer. So if you can work with the energy body so that that energetic disruption is repaired, then I think the cancer would never form. I don't know if the cancer has formed, whether or not, certainly for emotional causes. I think forgiveness is so important with cancer. So I usually give people Michael Rice's No Fault Forgiveness worksheet. He's the one that wrote Why Is This Happening to Me Again? He studied the ancient Aramaic and used the Jesus's teachings in the ancient Aramaic to develop a worksheet for forgiveness. So this is a very effective form. And Michael's had quite a few spontaneous remissions of cancer just with that. Now, it may be that if you go back and sleep in a bed with a geopathic stress and you still have the smart meter, I don't know if that would still keep your cancer going. It might. I mean, again, this is a different realm. This is a electromagnetic and physical realm versus forgiveness, which I think forgiveness can completely heal a chakra disruption.
In the Buddhist tradition.
So it depends on the cause.
If you have toxic chemical,
it's interesting. In breast cancer, most fibrocystic disease is in the upper outer quadrant. And most dioxin and other toxic chemicals are stored in the upper outer quadrant, you see. So if the toxic chemical is the cause, then probably the best thing would be to do chemical detox or cut the area out. I mean, I used to just go and cut all the abnormal tissue out of the upper outer quadrant, and I felt pretty sure that that wasn't going to turn into cancer because it wasn't in the patient anymore.
Yeah. Well, in both the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition, they're valuable to me because these people have studied the mind for consciousness for an awful long time, very, very intensely and immediately in their own experience. There is the physical body, not meaning the material body, but the physical world in general, the energetic world, and then beyond that, the causal world, which envelops the other two. They will actually, the energetic and the material come out of the causal. And the causal really is that divine place of presence. And so they would see both the energetic body and the, material body as being, ultimately, impacted by consciousness, by fundamental consciousness, and so that how those two express itself would be related to that. There's so many ways of coming at this, and I certainly do not have an expertise in some of the areas you've talked about, but I appreciate your sharing those with me. And
I think that spontaneous remission example would be that causal body energy, and I would imagine that it could cure any cause of cancer. It wouldn't matter. But the thing is that I don't know if you're aware of this, but a lot of spiritual healers have cured cancer and cancer's gone. Okay. They do a number of healings and the cancer's totally gone, but recurs 6 weeks later. And I just wonder if that 6 week recurrence isn't from some factor that is in the environment or emotional, the continued unforgiveness certainly could play a role too. So,
well, the antigenetic science.
There are methods to get rid of cancer, but then it can come back. So,
The Institute of Noetic Science, where I worked as a fellow, which is where I worked with Mika Swami for a while, they did an extensive piece of work, Brendan O'Regan, many, many years ago, on bringing together all of the literature on spontaneous remissions that were well-researched.
I have the book.
So you have the book.
It's very good.
That included maybe 35 cases of Lourdes out of all their millions of people who go there, and so on and so forth. Very well-documented cases, in the, often in the medical literature. The conclusion was that they could not find one single thread that could explain what happened to whom. It could be somebody did all kinds of things in terms of therapies. It could be another person's young man who said, you know, I think I'll go back to work in the fields where I'd love to be, and I'm not going to do anything else. There was no way to really predict it. I saw two of these people speak at the Institute, and one was an obstetrician gynecologist in the Washington State area, and another one was a fellow from Australia. And both of them extensively worked on their malignancies. One had, the fellow had a malignant melanoma that was spread throughout the body, and she had an ovarian cancer, which was similarly spread. They both did about everything you could think of. And I heard them speak about it when I was there. And in the end, they couldn't say what it was that it did or didn't do or why that these spontaneous remissions occurred. It would be nice if we understood it well enough, we'd be able to then, you know, replicate it in people. But unfortunately, I'm from whatever I know of the research that's been done, there is really not a whole lot of clarity about why one person gets sick and one person gets well from cancer. And, you know, in the beginning of Cancerwood, that that wonderful, wonderful book, they're sitting in the ward there, and one patient saying to the other, you know, how could this happen? They say, some people say cancer could just fly away like a butterfly out the window. And the other fellow said, well, for that you have to have a good conscience. So who knows? I don't know. But I appreciate your sense of it and your exploration of it.
Yeah, I just think that the realm that you're describing, the realm merging or bringing through the energy of that higher realm, is probably the closest thing that we have to the spontaneous remission energy. And whether it comes through slowly, which I'm sure it can, or whether it comes through very quickly, and that's what I described, the, you know, the about taking a minute or so to go from the crown to the feet, which is described in many cases. We don't know what causes it. We don't know what factors there are. My friend who was 36 and had that spontaneous remission in the hotel room, I mean, in the hospital room, she had no idea why she was given a second chance. But she went on, when I knew her, she was in her 50s, and she was involved in spiritual work. She had written screenplays for spiritual movies and was, you know, had a whole life ahead of her. And I guess that at some point her soul or higher self decided that it wasn't time for her to die of breast cancer.
Yeah.
She didn't. Yeah. I mean,
so there's a great mystery, huh? And we're still involved with, thank God.
It is a great mystery.
And we, you know, we work and live as best as we can with a mystery, and do all that we can to get as close to the source and as we can. And if grace befalls us, the right thing happens.
Right.
I shouldn't even say the right thing. Whatever's supposed to happen, happens.
Right. There's a great deal of medical research, as you know, with the effectiveness of mindfulness and lifestyle changes for heart disease. Heart disease seems to be a lot more closely related to this idea of stress than, say, cancer would be. Cancer is probably many, many different causes. And heart disease, on a physical level, seems to involve nanobacter as well as a spirochete. The same spirochete that's in periodontal disease has been seen in the plaque. So there may be an infectious component, so your immune system may be important with heart disease, but certainly there's a lot of evidence that stress is a major factor with heart disease. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, it's certainly a significant factor. Dean Ornish has put together a lot of the work related to stress and how it impacts upon the endothelial lining of the blood vessels. So certainly it has an effect. And I was reading the other day, about 2 weeks ago, a piece, an op-ed in the New York Times. It was about a physician named Bernie Lown, cardiologist, who was actually in the hospital as a patient in 92 and commenting on what he's commented on all his life, how inhumane in some ways medical treatment can be, certainly institutional treatment can be. He opened up the first coronary care unit, and he opened up the invented the defibrillator, and I was lucky enough to have him as one of my attending physicians in training. Also went on to win the Nobel Prize for Peace with a Russian physician some years later. I remember the first thing he said to me when we went through the coronary care unit was that he'd never seen anybody there who wasn't depressed in 6 to 18 months before they ended up there. So, I think there is clearly physiologic information and certainly anecdotal information that makes it quite clear. Also, there were studies done, and this has to do with diet as well as stress and time urgency, in terms of looking at Japanese immigrants to Hawaii and California relative to what happened to their incidence of heart disease as they enculturated. So there's no question that there are relationships between stress, environment, time urgency, all of these things, and heart disease, as well as probably other ailments as well. And so we know that, and yet even those of us who know it and teach some of the ways to overcome these things, it's if you tell somebody to work with meditation 20 minutes, a half an hour a day, they may do it for a couple of weeks and likely it'll drop off. If you give them a prescription blank that tells them to go to physical therapy twice a day for 2 months, they'll be there every appointment. So we're such a physically based culture that it seeps its way into our value system. People tell me they can't do meditation in the morning when they go on traveling because they get busy. They're in hotel rooms. I say, well, did you brush your teeth in the morning? Or did you forget that also because you were you were traveling? Well, people don't forget to brush their teeth and take a shower. So we have learned not to attend to any aspects of our being, whether it be environmental in a more sensitive way rather than the core things, or whether it's psychological or spiritual. We don't attend to them because although we say that they have value, we have learned to really, at some deep level, value only those things that are physical. That's how we spend our money, and that's how we give our time.
True.
So,
well, we're coming up on, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, we're coming up on the end of the hour. Would you like to give your contact information once more?
Sure. My website is really my name, Elliot Dasher, one word, ELLIOTTDACHER.org. And that's my website, which has got many videos and blogs and other things on it, and information about my books.
And I want to mention that there's a CD that comes with the book, Aware, Awake, and Alive, that you want to mention that, what's on the CD?
Well, the book is the meditation course I do at hospitals, and it's an 8-week course. And the CD is an effort to be able to give people some help with practicing the meditation process with an audio CD and guided meditation if they need so. So it really just complements the program that's in the book.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a delightful conversation.
Great. Same here, and to you and your listeners. Have a nice rest of the day.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb. I've been interviewing Dr. Elliot Dasher on Aware, Awake, and Alive. Please visit his website for more information, and please join us next week for Temple of Health Radio Show.
Great. Thanks, Susan.
Great. Thanks a lot.